So kia ora and welcome to this South Pacific Weather Training Teleclass Lecture. My name is Jane Barnett and I'm speaking to you from the NZNO National Division of Infection Control Nurses Annual Conference, which this year is being hosted by Hamilton in the North Island of New Zealand. Themes of the conference so far have been MDROs, quality processes and networking communication. So what better way to network than with our colleagues around the world via a Weber training teleclass. So greetings to Paul Weber, who I know is listening in Canada today. So for those of you listening in who aren't familiar with the teleclass concept, like our speaker actually, this lecture is being broadcast live to hundreds of people in New Zealand and Australia. It will then be listened to on the rebroadcast to our North American and Northern Hemisphere colleagues by countless more, and then we'll go on to the recordings part of the Weber Training website and be listened to even more. So there's no pressure, David. Okay. But the concept of teleclass education is a fantastic one. It enables many people to access high-quality speakers at minimal cost and also enables Paul Weber to make this education available free to those in developing countries. So I think we're all in agreement that it's a great idea. I'm very supportive of it. One of the things that enables him to do this is sponsorship, and today I'd like to acknowledge our UK-based sponsors for this lecture. Mike Booty heads up Intronics in the UK. It's new to the Australasian market, and their automated movement activated recording device can be seen at the Johnson & Johnson stand here at the conference. So those of you in the audience might wish to go and have a look at that. Thank you, Mike, very much for your support. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome our speaker today, Professor David Patterson, who's one of the keynote speakers of this conference. David's newly appointed Professor of Medicine at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. He was formerly Director of the Antibiotic Management Program and Chief of Transplant Infectious Diseases at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, USA. He's currently a consultant in infectious diseases at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital and consultant microbiologist for Pathology Queensland. David has a special interest in the epidemiology, detection and treatment of multiply resistant gram-negative bacilli. Additionally, his clinical expertise is in managing infections in critically ill and immunocompromised patients. He's had over 140 peer-reviewed articles published and has written chapters for a wide range of books in the field of infectious diseases. His subject for today's teleclass is extended spectrum beta-lactamases and infection control. Welcome to New Zealand, David. We promise not to mention the rugby. thank you very much for being our Weber training speaker today.
Well, thank you very much for that nice introduction. And unfortunately today I'm probably going to offend a few people, so hopefully not you personally, but maybe some of our friends in North America. So I'm going to talk about ESBL producers, and as you heard in the introduction, I've spent the last 10 years at the University of Pittsburgh, and you can see it looks like quite a nice city, although sometimes looks can be deceiving. But what is notable about Pittsburgh is that it is a city that is on three rivers. And in fact, there was previously a stadium in Pittsburgh called the Three Rivers Stadium, where the Pittsburgh Steelers would play. And from time to time, there were great rock bands who'd play there, for example. So I had the pleasure of seeing U2 at the Three Rivers Stadium. And I thought, I also saw them in Brisbane. And there were some differences in the crowd reactions, which I guess show some differences between how an Australian or a New Zealander would view the world and how a North American might view the world. So Bono got up on stage and said, "Every time I clap my hands, a child dies in Darfur." And in Pittsburgh, people said, "Where's Darfur? Is that somewhere on the south side of Chicago?" In Australia, when he did that, people said, "Well, stop clapping your hands then." So there's a slight difference in attitude between those in the southern hemisphere and perhaps those in the northern hemisphere. There are also some other differences. Now, I come from Brisbane, so living in Pittsburgh, where there was frequent snow and ice, was not much fun. Got a little quiz for you. You know, is this Brisbane or Pittsburgh? Now, the answer seems obvious, but in fact, this is hail after a particularly nasty hailstorm in Brisbane. So sometimes looks can be misleading, as I said before. Again, not wanting to offend anybody, however I will. You know, we do have differences in the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere in terms of, general society attitudes, and sometimes that reflects physical fitness and sport. I might just flick over that, but this was this is the local gymnasium in Pittsburgh, and you can see that very conveniently there's an escalator to get in there, and this was the neighbour's cat. So, however, there are some real differences in sport. This is actually, I better get back to medicine, shouldn't I, before I talk about other stuff. This is actually from the New England Journal, and this is a slide showing community-acquired MRSA. And this was, I think, the St. Louis Rams. And the players who have the coloured squares were players who were colonised with community-acquired MRSA. So sport sometimes does make the medical news. And I guess the illustration from that is, you know, many of our germs are passed from skin to skin, and that was a perfect example. I guess our North American colleagues maybe are not as interested in rugby as we are. And I should have something from the Olympics, but unfortunately rugby is not an Olympic sport. But I noticed last year that Tonga 25 defeated USA 15, which I thought was pretty impressive, particularly when you look at the populations. Tonga has a population of 100,000, USA 300 million. Well, I like to, think of things statistically. So my adjusted scores, adjusted for population, would be Tonga 75,000 defeated United States 15. Again, I'm sorry to all of you in North America who may be offended. Schools are different in North America compared to here. You know, I think in Australia and New Zealand we have fire drills. In the United States, certainly, they have firearm drills in schools. And, there's certainly a passion for hunting. You know, my infectious disease colleagues would frequently go hunting deer on the weekends. And I guess sense of humour may not always be identical. I'm glad we've got some Canadians on the line, because you may have heard of this show in Australia called The Chaser, in which these guys used a car with pretend Canadian flags and got right up to George Bush's hotel, and then a comedian dressed as Osama bin Laden arrived for the APEC conference. But I guess that sort of humour wouldn't translate necessarily into the United States. But anyway, there are some great things, before I talk about ESBLs, not better, about the United States and Western Europe. For example, the amount of cash available for researchers and to allow research to flourish, because it really does need funding, is just incredible. And there are people with incredible drive. Lance Armstrong, you'd know. This fellow here is Thomas Starzl, who I worked with in Pittsburgh, who did the world's first liver transplant. So pioneers in medicine are certainly widespread in the United States, as an example. But let's talk about ESBLs. I'm sorry for that long preamble. But throughout the world, there really has been an explosion in interest in ESBL-producing organisms. In the last 2 years, more than 1,000 articles have been published on beta-lactamases, more than 300 on ESBLs. ICAC is our big infectious diseases conference, and more than 100 abstracts just on ESBL. So clearly, we've heard today in New Zealand, ESBL producers are an issue. Worldwide, they are a huge issue. So I want to briefly summarise what is an ESBL, describe why ESBL production is important, because it's meaningless for us to find antibiotic resistance if it doesn't mean anything to the patient. And I think that's a focus we've always got to have in infection control. One thing is doing surveillance, but another is, does this have a difference on whether a patient lives or dies, or whether a patient suffers more or has a longer length of hospital stay? That has to be our focus, not just whether we find colonization with an antibiotic-resistant organism. There are some special issues with particular organisms, and I might not have time to go into those in detail, but I really want to summarize the literature that's out there about infection control and ESBL-producing organisms. So I'm going to say something else that's a little bit controversial, and this is, you know, I think there is so much attention worldwide in infection control circles on MRSA and VRE, these gram-positive resistance problems. But in fact, I don't think they're the world's biggest problem in infection control. And the reason for that is that even if we have MRSA, or even if we had VRSA, there are going to be a number of new drugs which are going to be available to treat these organisms. So while they are bad, and while they may adversely affect patient outcome, particularly if someone's got MRSA and we give them an anti-staphylococcal penicillin and therefore they fail therapy, that's clearly a bad outcome. But it's not, as a global perspective, the end of the world, because we do have a number of new drugs available against MRSA and VRE. However, let's look at the new drug classes that are in production active against gram-negative organisms. And this is the list. There are none. So why ESBL producers are important is that they are on that pathway of resistance in gram-negatives that leads to a pathway where there are absolutely no antibiotics left. So in Pittsburgh, we had a number of patients who had gram-negative infections resistant to every single antibiotic. If you were to go to an ICU in Athens or Rio de Janeiro or New York City, most likely you would also encounter patients who unfortunately are infected with organisms, gram-negative organisms resistant to every single antibiotic. There are not going to be any new drug classes active against these gram-negative organisms in the next 5 years, and possibly not even in the next 10 years. And that's the implication. ESBLs are a step along this path to the pre-antibiotic era, where we have nothing at all to treat our patients. So now for the boring part. Unfortunately, if you look at the scientific literature on beta-lactamases, it is very, very easy to get overwhelmed. And the reason for that is that the scientists who describe beta-lactamases describe them in these sets of three-letter abbreviations, which are completely arbitrary. For example, TEM is named after the first patient, Mrs. Temonira, who had a particular beta-lactamase. Others are named after the city in which they were first described. Some of them describe some of the chemical characteristics of the particular beta-lactamase. So this is a tough area for anyone outside the field to feel they can penetrate and understand. But I am hopefully going to make it a little bit understandable for you. So I mentioned there's a lot of different types of beta-lactamases. ESBLs are only one of the types of beta-lactamases. And just to step backwards, beta-lactamases are enzymes produced by the bacteria that physically destroy penicillins and cephalosporins. So they break open one of the bonds in the chemical structure and inactivate the antibiotic, which is pretty amazing that bacteria could develop such a mechanism. But a characteristic of ESBLs is that they destroy the third generation cephalosporins, and their commonly used antibiotics like ceftriaxone, which for many years has been the world's number one injectable antibiotic, and other antibiotics like ceftazidime and related antibiotics which maybe we don't use very much, like aztreonam. So that's the first thing they do. They can destroy those very commonly used antibiotics. Interestingly, they don't destroy all of the cephalosporins. There are some that they don't, cefoxitin or cefotetan, and they also are not able to destroy carbapenem antibiotics, and that's antibiotics like meropenem. The good news, if there is any good news, is that these particular enzymes can actually be inhibited. So we can stop their activity by combining antibiotics with beta-lactamase inhibitors like clavulanic acid. So you know, for example, amoxicillin and clavulanic acid, a widely used antibiotic, it, in theory, shouldn't be destroyed by ESBLs because that clavulanic acid actually inhibits beta-lactamase production. We'll talk a little bit more about that in some detail as to why that might not be true in real life. But this is the actual definition of an ESBL. So how did ESBLs get here? You know, why do we have them? Well, it goes back a long time, and the story starts in 1964, but it's an interesting story in that it shows how adaptable bacteria are. You know, I read once, you know, if there was a nuclear explosion, the only thing that would survive on Earth are cockroaches. But that's garbage. What would really survive anything are bacteria, because they are so adaptable to environmental changes. So in June 1964, ampicillin was introduced in Europe. And yet, within 6 months of the introduction of that antibiotic into Europe, a lady in Athens in Greece was found to have a urinary tract infection with E. coli, but this E. coli was resistant to ampicillin. And it turned out that the mechanism of that resistance was that the bacteria had learnt to produce a beta-lactamase that could destroy ampicillin. So that was really one of the first examples of what we call a transferable beta-lactamase. And as I mentioned, in honour of Mrs. Temoniera, that particular beta-lactamase is called TEM1. They certainly didn't have very strict privacy laws in Greece in 1964. Well, the cephalosporins have been a very, very important class of drugs for us. And again, a little bit of history, again coming from Europe. Shortly after World War II, a microbiologist called Giuseppe Brotzu was looking out over the bay in his town of Cagliari in Sardinia. And those of you who have been to Sardinia know it's called the Emerald Coast. Beautiful, clear, green water. But when Professor Brotzu looked over the Bay of Cagliari, it was murky. And it wasn't mud. It was, unfortunately, sewage was being pumped directly into this bay. However, he noticed that there were some spots of clearing where the water was crystal clear amongst this murkiness. And he was clever, and he had the hypothesis that there must be some antibiotic substance in that clear water that was killing all the E. coli and other bacteria. And so what he did is he cultured the clear water and grew a fungus, and that fungus is called Cephalosporium. And from that fungus have been synthesized our cephalosporin antibiotics. So there have been a number of classes of cephalosporins developed over the years, and the third generation cephalosporins were really the strongest. So ceftriaxone, for example, could kill strep pneumo, the pneumococcus, could kill staph aureus, but it could also kill E. coli and Klebsiella, a whole range of organisms. So they really have been absolutely magical antibiotics. But back to another history lesson. Just like the situation where in Greece, when ampicillin was introduced, 6 months later we had an ampicillin-resistant E. coli. In Germany, when the third generation cephalosporins were introduced in 1981, by 1982 in Frankfurt, there were Klebsiella isolates which were resistant to those third generation cephalosporins. So that same bacterial evolution was in process. And what we know is that there was a mutation in the bacteria, in the gene that encoded a particular beta-lactamase, a simple beta-lactamase. The mutation led to a change in the enzyme, in the beta-lactamase, so it had a wider active site, and it could now accommodate and destroy the third-generation cephalosporins. So this sort of leads me to another very important, I believe, a Nobel Prize-winning discovery. And that is that the IQ of bacteria has recently been discovered. So I've got a little prize. If anyone can tell me the IQ of a bacteria. Well, it has been determined, and it's 10 to the minus 5. So imagine how stupid a bacterium is. Now, our trouble is that in many infections, there are 10 to the 8th bacteria. I'm not very good at maths, but 10 to the minus 5 by 10 to the 8th equals 10 to the 3rd. The real IQ of bacteria that are infecting us is 1,000. They are very, very clever. Well, they're not clever, but they're very adaptable in response to environmental stressors. So that is one of our problems, particularly with gram-negatives, because we haven't been able to keep up in terms of antibiotic development. So let's get back to ESBLs. ESBL stands for extended spectrum beta-lactamase. Now, the extended spectrum means compared to a parent beta-lactamase, which had a much narrower spectrum, for example, Mrs. Temoniera's beta-lactamase that would just destroy ampicillin, the ESBLs are mutants and they've got a much broader spectrum, so now they can destroy even the cephalosporins and even the third generation cephalosporins. So that's why we call them extended spectrum beta-lactamases. Now, I'm going to offend a lot of people. So this slide is censored, and that's because it has something to do with sex, and unfortunately, our bacterial friends are extremely promiscuous. So not only are they adaptable to environmental stressors, you wouldn't dream of knowing what goes on inside your gut. And basically, there is transfer of genetic elements from one bacteria to another, usually via plasmids. So plasmids are circular pieces of DNA which can be transferred from one bacteria to another. So one bacteria has got an ESBL gene on its plasmid. It mates with another bacteria in our gut and transfers that ESBL gene to the new bacteria, and that's why we can have spread, for example, within species. So I heard Pat talked earlier about a person having an ESBL-producing E. coli and later having an ESBL-producing Klebsiella. Most likely that E. coli and Klebsiella, you know, one romantic night and there was mood music and whatever, but they got together and there was transfer of those resistance genes. Now, this is not meant to scare you, but this is Acinetobacter. And I've just color-coded for you the source of the genes in Acinetobacter. And you can see if it's green, this Acinetobacter mated with Pseudomonas. If it was yellow, it mated with Salmonella. And you can see it's mated both with Pseudomonas and with Salmonella. This mauvey sort of color with E. coli, blue other bacteria. It couldn't even remember the names of the other bacteria it slept with. So you can see how promiscuous our gram-negative friends are and how they can acquire lots and lots of genes encoding different resistance mechanisms. And that contributes to our problems as infection control people. So with ESBL producers, we've heard already today that Klebsiella historically has been the number one organism that has been an ESBL producer. Part of the reason for that is that it is quite happy to accept genes or accept plasmids, so it is sort of fairly promiscuous. E. coli and Proteus, sometimes Enterobacter. Now, Enterobacter can have genes of its own on its own chromosome, but increasingly is also accepting plasmids that have got ESBL genes on them. And in some parts of the world, Salmonella is increasingly likely to be an ESBL producer. Now, while we do talk about multi-drug resistance in Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter, and things like carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter are a horrible problem in many parts of the world, I don't want to deny them at all as a problem, because they're most likely the ones that are going to be resistant to all antibiotics. But strictly speaking, it's not correct to say that they are ESBL producers. Even though they may be multi-drug resistant, and may be resistant to cephalosporins, including third-generation cephalosporins, strictly speaking, it's because of different genes, not the ESBL genes. So just as a little bit of, you know, fine-tuning in terminology. So I better get it, make it real and get back to a patient, and I thought I'd give you a little...
Gentlemen, stay with us. We're trying to solve the static problem. The speaker will be back in just a moment as they dial back in.
To the supermarket and bought chicken and turkey and beef and pork, and he was able to grow E. coli from the vast majority of these samples, which I've been led to believe is actually quite to be expected. I better cook my dinner tonight. But what he found is that there were CTXM producing E. coli in food purchased at supermarkets in the United States. Now, why would there be antibiotic resistant organisms in the food that we eat? Well, my guess is that the vast majority of farmers in China or Thailand or various parts of the world feed their animals antibiotics so their animals don't get sick, so therefore their animals are bigger and fatter and are worth more. So quinolones are widely used in animal feed. You know, quinolones are antibiotics like ciprofloxacin. In Australia, I have to call the government for approval to prescribe a quinolone. In China, every farmer is doing it and giving it to his animals. There are third generation cephalosporins actually injected into eggs in some countries. And I've even heard that there are crop dusters with antifungal drugs that are being sprayed across citrus plantations. So you can see one of the reasons why ESBL producers may be occurring in the community, and that is because of agricultural antimicrobial use. Getting back to Dr. Doy's experiments, 85% of the E. coli in Pittsburgh from food specimens were resistant to third-generation cephalosporins. So it really is quite frightening. And then when you look at rates of ESBL producers in various parts of the world, you know, you'll see places like China, 37% of Klebpneumo, 31% of E. coli, you know, similarly large proportions in Latin America and some parts of Europe, Australia and New Zealand, where we're lucky. But I think things are going to change. Another aspect of community resistance is the potential for over-the-counter access to antibiotics. I went to Turkey a few years ago, and I went to just a regular chemist, and they had Augmentin just there for sale. I didn't need a prescription, and it was like about $2, and I thought, oh, I'll buy, that's a bargain. But then I subsequently realized it's probably, you know, probably dodgy and is inactive. But this was a lovely study from Bangkok. 10 well-trained medical students who were pretending to be patients presented to 40 drug stores with common complaints amongst medical students, such as urethral discharge, acute watery diarrhea, and almost all of them received antibiotics, and often the choice was quite inappropriate with respect to the choice of drug or the duration of treatment. Another study from Bangkok more recently, 6 doctors this time were trained as mock patients, well, not mock people really, who pretended to have a friend who had a particular illness. So it wasn't even them. And you can see, for example, symptoms of sinusitis, a large proportion of them received, for example, quinolones, and quinolones that were probably like norfloxacin that don't even get much systemic absorption. So that is certainly a problem worldwide. Well, let's get back to the implications of ESBL production. We lose susceptibility to a range of antibiotic classes. Therefore, if someone is sick and we make the wrong antibiotic choice, we know that if we make the wrong choice and someone is seriously ill, they have an increased chance of dying. So that is the basic implication of why ESBL producers are important. To quantify that, in a study of bloodstream infections with ESBL producers, if you had an ESBL producer, you had a 34% chance of dying versus a 20% chance for non-ESBL producers. Almost half of all people with ESBL producers in their blood did not get the right antibiotic up front. So that is why infection control matters, because people live or die if they get an ESBL producer, a serious infection with an ESBL producer. They die if they get the wrong antibiotic. Another implication is my studies have shown that carbapenems, things like meropenem or imipenem, are the best drugs for ESBL producers. The mortality is lowest if you get those antibiotics. But if, you know, you tell a doctor that and the doctor says, oh, carbapenems are great, I'm going to use a carbapenem on every patient I see, the more carbapenems that are used means the more selection pressure leading now to carbapenem-resistant organisms, like CRAB, carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter. Another one called KPC. This is a Klebsiella strain found widely in New York City that is now resistant to carbapenems. So I've heard that in some ICUs in New York, empiric therapy on day one if a patient is sick is tigecycline plus polymyxin. So two drugs that in our hospitals are virtually never used are used on day one because of antibiotic resistance there. Another issue with ESBL producers is that even though they do destroy the third generation cephalosporins, in some situations they don't destroy them so much that our lab would be able to say this organism is resistant to a third generation cephalosporin. So, for example, you'll see here that almost 50% of ESBL producers in this particular study were susceptible to cefotaxime if you looked at the basic lab report. And now there's all sorts of people saying, European Commission on Antibiotic Susceptibility Testing is saying, let's change the goalposts so we don't make that mistake. But the summary of the problem is that our labs have to be up to speed in detecting these resistance problems, otherwise we as clinicians may never know about them. So I think that's very important for you, and I believe in New Zealand, for example, that labs are very strong at detecting ESBL producers, but we have to make sure as infection control clinicians that our lab is giving us sensible information. It's not that ESBLs are not there because the lab didn't even look for them. It's got to be they're not there because of the good things we're doing. Now, maybe in the interest of time, I might skip over some of the issues with various antibiotics and get to the crux of the matter. But in some parts of the world, cephalosporins are being combined with beta-lactamase inhibitors to try and overcome the ESBL problem. In some places in the world, kefepime is advocated as a good drug for ESBL producers. In my opinion, that's not a great way to go. Some people are saying, let's not even bother looking for ESBLs. Let's just change the goalposts in the laboratory, change the breakpoints, and therefore all of the ESBL producers will be recorded as resistant, and therefore it'll be easy. But I think it does give us a good signal. ESBL producer means, as infection control clinicians, we've got to do something about it. So I would, even if we did change breakpoints, I would advocate still looking for ESBLs. Timentin, which is used in some places in the world, may sometimes look susceptible to ESBL producers. I wouldn't recommend it as a great drug. I mentioned tigecycline as a new antibiotic that does have activity against ESBL producers. So far, we've got lab evidence of activity, but we don't have clinical evidence of activity. And I mentioned carbapenems, that they really are the treatment of choice for ESBL producers, serious infections with them. And that includes the use of ertapenem. There is a new carbapenem coming along called doripenem, which does have activity against ESBL producers, and we may see that being used in our hospitals in the future. I mentioned in some parts of the world, Salmonella is increasingly important as being an ESBL producer, and it really, even though in our hospitals we may have a lot of infection control neurons firing with an ESBL producing Klebsiella and bump up our infection control, similarly we should be doing this if we see weird organisms like Salmonella as ESBL producers. We still have the infection control implication. Well, let's, in this last 10 to 15 minutes, nail down what we should do as infection control clinicians with respect to ESBL producers. Well, the first thing is, should we do anything at all? The obvious answer is yes. Now, someone might say, you might get one of those funny doctors who say, well, give me the evidence for doing something. Sorry. Well, the evidence is, there have been more than 50 outbreaks of ESBL producers published. And in those outbreaks, they used some sort of molecular means of determining if strains were related. So, for example, they used the pulsed field gel electrophoresis, PFGE. In every one of those outbreaks, there were strains that were related in that same hospital. In other words, there was black and white evidence that there was somehow person-to-person transmission of ESBL producers in those hospitals. So for me, that is evidence that we should do something, because we know historically that there is person-to-person spread of ESBL producers. And this is an example. You don't need to know anything about PFGE, but you could say to me, well, those patterns look the same. And if the patterns are the same, it means different patients have got the same organism. Well, why do we get ESBL producers? It is similar to other nasty things like VRE. VRE is due to enterococcus, that's a gut organism. Klebsiella is a gut organism, so it starts in our gut. we get fecal colonization. And then, as I've mentioned, in hospitalized patients, we get colonization of the skin in greatest concentrations in the perianal area, but over the duration of hospitalization, there'll be colonization of all of the skin. Then we, as healthcare professionals, touch the patient, or also potentially touch the environment around the patient, colonize our hands, and then go to the next patient and transfer the organism. There have been some beautiful studies done on Klebsiella. These were done more than 30 years ago, showing that Klebsiella can survive on the hands for 10 or 15 minutes. Now, that's not a long time compared to, for example, Staph aureus, which can stay there all the time, but that's enough time to go from one patient to another. I did a fun little study in Pittsburgh, actually mimicked what my friends in Brisbane had done earlier, where we had an outbreak of ESBL producers. In this particular hospital in the US, every patient was in a single room, and in that room there was a tap, there was soap, there was paper. You would have expected that every person leaving that room would have come out with clean hands. Well, I thought I'd better prove that. I like evidence. So I hid outside the patient's room, and when a nurse came out the door, I jumped on them and got their hand, and I'd filled a sterile glove with broth, and I put their hand into their glove, squiggled their fingers around, and cultured what was on the hands of the nurse, or I also did it to doctors and medical students and various other people who left those patients' rooms. 25% of the nursing staff had a pathogenic organism on their hands. Now, you would have, of course, expected that doctors did much better than that. So about 40% of the doctors had a ESBL producer or MRSA or VRE on their hands. So I like that as sort of a graphic example of, let's show people whether or not they are complying with hand hygiene. You know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's whether they've got a resistant organism on their hand, and we were able to prove that. So hands are the vehicle. Now, there are occasionally removable environmental foci. So in one particular obstetrics unit, the ultrasound gel for doing ultrasounds was contaminated with ESBL producers. In another hospital, glass thermometers that were reused were colonized. There has been an example of a contaminated bronchoscope. And there is an example of a nurse who had chronic dermatitis and had chronic hand carriage with ESBL producers. So occasionally there is an environmental focus that we can remove. And I would recommend that if you have an outbreak of ESBL producers, you do some environmental screening to see what is out there, just in case there is an environmental focus that should be removed. Arresting outbreaks with ESBL producers. I am an advocate for screening contacts of people who've been known to be colonized or infected, then instituting contact isolation precautions for those people who are colonized or infected, and of course adding alerts so that when those people change from one unit of the hospital to another, that they are also put into contact isolation in the subsequent units. I have been personally responsible for an outbreak of ESBL producers in an ICU when I was a registrar. I forgot to tell the ICU registrar who was accepting the patient that my patient had an ESBL producing organism. And 2 weeks later, 8 people in that ICU were infected. So you need to have a slick system so silly people like me don't create problems. Now, Is there success? There are numerous examples in which small outbreaks of ESBL producers have been arrested using these traditional infection control procedures. So screening for asymptomatic carriers, contact isolation for everybody who's colonized, and massive attention to hand hygiene. I wouldn't necessarily do, you know, large-scale rectal screening unless there was a massive outbreak. I would tend to think about screening high-risk areas like ICUs, maybe people transferred from residential care facilities or other known areas with outbreaks. So I know now if I get a New Zealander who comes to my hospital, I'm going to do a rectal swab as soon as I see them. Now, when can we clear patients who are colonized? Well, we don't really know. My feeling is that once you're colonized, you are colonized forever. However, that might not be practical. You might not be able to keep someone in contact isolation every time they come back. I certainly think that positivity will be enhanced if you've recently received antibiotics. Some people say wait 6 months and then do 3 weekly swabs, and if they're negative, then you could take the person off contact isolation precautions. And that might be a reasonable sort of middle ground. I don't know, though. This is an example where ESBLs got established. They were endemic. So in this particular hospital in France, there were well over 100 isolations per year of new patients with ESBL producers. They thought, well, we better do something about it. So they started contact isolation. They realized that that wasn't working. And then they thought, well, we better go down to grassroots level and find out what's going on. And they found out, for example, that radiographers were coming into units and they didn't have any education about hand hygiene. Nurses ran out of supplies, went to a clean supply room with their gear on and obviously contaminated supplies. They went back and did an analysis of what was going wrong. When they address that, you can see the substantial decrease in cases per year. So it's one thing saying we're going to do screening and contact isolation. There's another thing for it working. You really have to adapt it for your local situation. Whoops. In some situations, antibiotic use has to be modified before we'll get control of ESBL producers. I don't think there's any doubt that cephalosporins, particularly third-generation cephalosporins, are a driver of selection of ESBL producers. And there are now numerous studies in which if we decrease use of third-generation cephalosporins, we have to replace them with something, replaced, for example, with beta-lactam-beta-lactamase inhibitor combinations, that there is reduction in ESBL producers. So I think this is, if your initial pure infection control approach has not worked, I would have to get your doctor colleagues on board for a modification of antibiotic use. Well, I know my time's up. There are, unfortunately, you know, thinking about the future, a number of reasons why we're all going to have jobs for the rest of our lives. There are going to be more and more problems with antibiotics in the future, but I've found a solution. I used Google and found that there was a journal called Acta Astronaut, and they found that if you shot bacteria into outer space, they became less resistant to antibiotics. So I think that's the answer, but it's really not rocket science as to the basics. Now, this is partly from my time in the US, where, I better not offend anyone, but sometimes you have to appeal to the selfish side of a person. So I would say to them, you know, clean your hands for the sake of the patient. But what I really wanted to say to them, to make them change their behavior, is clean your hands for yourself. I had a number of doctors who had herpes, you know, herpetic Whitlow or herpetic keratitis, which they claimed was not recreationally acquired. And of course, if we do contact bodily secretions, we may get herpes at work. ESBL producers or MRSA we don't want to take home with us. Around the world, this explosion of Clostridium difficile, including very nasty strains, we don't want to get that at work and get sick. Of course, antibiotic prescribing, if it's silly, is going to just put pressure on any antibiotic resistance problem. So antibiotics are not the solution for every person who's got a fever, or of course for every positive culture. And it's really us as clinicians who hold the key. The drug companies are not going to bail us out with these resistant gram negatives. We have to get on the right side of our colleagues to change behavior. Well, it's easy to talk about, but that's what we're going to have to do to solve these resistance problems like ESBL producers. So I think I've gone over time. I'm sorry, but thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for that. I think you've clarified a lot for us, and your sense of humour has come through, which is fantastic. I've learned a lot about what microbiologists do before they go on holiday as well, which is good insight. Sadly, we don't have time for questions. Those of you here at the conference, I know, will probably want to speak to David at some point if you do have questions. For those of you listening in via the telephone link, then please don't hesitate to email me with any questions. The email is on the slides and handout, and I'll make sure I pass those on to David. Also, an apology for those of you listening in. I think we might have lost the connection there to the bridge line for a few minutes. Maybe they didn't like your jokes.
No, I think that's probably right.
I hope that you didn't lose us for very long, so that's great. In closing, thank you very much, David, for your contribution to this teleclass. It's been fantastic. I'd also like to thank UK-based sponsors once again, Intronics for their support of today's Weber Training teleclass, the organising committee for allowing us once again to have a Weber Training session at this conference, and of course the technical support at the back. Dennis, thank you very much for enabling this to go ahead. On your final slide, for those of you listening in, you will see the South Pacific teleclasses for 2008. We have one final teleclass, which is due to be broadcast in October by David Hammer from Christchurch. From all of us here in Hamilton, New Zealand, thank you very much for listening in today, and goodbye.